Channel open. Welcome back to Weekly Trek, a proud member of the Tricorder Transmissions podcast network. I am your host, Alex Perry.
What's today's date? The date.
Today's show was recorded on April 20th, 2019, and is current through the end of Star Trek Discovery Season 2. So beware of spoilers, and boy, are there some big spoilers. So if you haven't watched Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2, I highly recommend you stop listening, go watch it, and then come back, because we are discussing all of the fallout from the finale of Star Trek Discovery Season 2 as it sets up Star Trek Discovery Season 3. All right, let's get into the show.
Good day, Voyager, and welcome to A Briefing with Neelix. Catchy title, isn't it?
Weekly Trek is a 30-minute news show covering the biggest stories from the Star Trek franchise. We are in a new golden age of Star Trek. There are four television shows at some point in production, rumors of yet more on the way, and enough merchandise to fill the Bajoran wormhole. So stick with me and I'll help you sort the real facts from a lot of the Dominion propaganda that you'll find online. But I can't do this alone, and my guest this week is my first returning guest for Weekly Trek Next Generation. That is Thad Haight. Thad, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back, and it's exciting to be making Weekly Trek history as the first returning guest.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to have you. And of course, you are the host of the fabulous Delta Flyer podcast. When are you guys kicking off season three?
Soon-ish. We're still on a hiatus at the moment due to some life events happening with my co-host, but we should be back within the next couple months.
Awesome. Well, I am looking forward to hearing you guys talk about Basics Part 2. I very much enjoyed listening to the Part 1 discussion with our good friend and fellow Tricorder host, John Krikorian.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to record.
All right, Thad, you know the deal. Tell me what's got you feeling good about Star Trek at the moment. What's got you moving at Warp 10?
Well, I feel like this is probably an obvious answer, but the Star Trek Discovery finale was, for the most part, pretty amazing.
Hooray!
We got the great scenes of the Enterprise. I mean, in part one, when they got onto the Enterprise, for those entire scenes, I just had the hugest grin on my face. We had the sounds and the visuals, and just everything was perfect. And I really like how they tied the story together. There were some twists I didn't expect coming. I was not expecting the Kelpians to show up. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to season three, which will not be anytime soon.
Yeah, I am a massive sucker for a surprise team up. And so the appearance of the Klingons, the appearance of the Kelpians was like a red rag to a bull as far as I was concerned. I was totally on board with all of that. That was really, really nice. Love seeing the Enterprise. I thought they did the Enterprise really well. We'll talk more about that since we have some news stories on the Enterprise to talk about this week. But yeah, it was a neatly wrapped up season. And of course, they are venturing into a very bold new world by heading 950 years into the future, pretty much beyond any point to which there has been a previous reference in the Star Trek canon. So operating with almost an entirely blank slate.
Yeah, that's definitely exciting because they can do pretty much anything they want next season.
Pretty much anything they want. Well, my thing that I'm feeling good about Star Trek this week is also comes from the finale. We got another book reference in the finale. Very quick moment, so quick that the captions actually missed it, and we only got confirmation of it thanks to TrekCore's interview with Michelle Paradise. But there is a moment in the season finale in which Pike refers to the character of Number One, who had been referred to as Number One throughout the whole season, as Una, which is the name that the character has in the Star Trek novels, particularly that was the name for the character in Desperate Hours, the Star Trek Discovery novel, but also it's been around for a few years, going back to the Star Trek Legacies trilogy for the 50th anniversary, which was a trilogy of books written by Greg Cox, David Mack, and Dayton Warden, Kevin Dillmore, which actually are really, really nice books, especially if you like the character. I really recommend diving in, even though they were written pre-Discovery. I actually feel like they sit very well alongside the Discovery aesthetic. So if you're a Discovery fan and an original series fan, you find a lot to like about these books. But it's just another really nice moment in which the books were getting some respect from the show. That's something we've seen start to happen more over the course of the season. Obviously, Control as a concept originally came from the novels, so the execution was quite different. We also got our first references to the Discovery novels, particularly The Ways to the Stars by Una McCormack. So that's one of the things I've really enjoyed about this season, has been those little moments as a big book fan, and looking forward to, well, who knows if we'll get any more. Maybe we will in some of the other shows. Obviously now with Discovery moving into a new part of the timeline, I think the canon connections will decrease, but it was really nice to have gotten that for Star Trek Discovery Season 2. Thaddy, you're a book reader, right?
Yes, I haven't read quite as many as you have, but yes.
Very few have, so that's okay.
Maybe Justin Ozer has.
Justin definitely has. He has read more than I have.
But I loved learning that. I missed it completely when watching the episode.
Me too. I did not catch it.
But it was great to see that confirmation. I love that because they did a great explanation for that name, which, if we want to go even further back, the name comes from the Legacies trilogy, as you mentioned, but the Legacies trilogy drew on the backstory that was originally established in Vulcan's Glory, which was a novel from the 80s written by D.C. Fontana.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
That one didn't establish the name of Una, but mm-hmm. It did establish that she was from Illyria.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. And I also missed it when the episode was first on. I got to the end of the episode and thought, oh, so they're just going to go with the number one thing, especially when at the end of the episode, they ask her to state her name. And I was like, what's she going to say? And she says number one. So I thought it hadn't come up. I missed the earlier reference and someone pointed it out to me. But I'm super, super thrilled by it. So hopefully, I think my guess would be if there's anybody you can credit for that, it's going to be Kirsten Beyer as a former Star Trek novelist, now Star Trek Discovery staff writer, now Star Trek Picard show, whatever it ends up being called, producer, for having that influence over the writer's room, and really, really thrilled to see it.
Yeah.
So with that, let's turn to, well, perhaps not this week's top stories, but the last couple of weeks' top stories.
There's a war going on, and I'm a reporter.
Yeah, you had to go on vacation when the Discovery finale was going on.
I know, it was a poorly planned vacation. But yes, as Thad mentioned, I've been away for the last 2 weeks. And as a result, Weekly Trek has been on hiatus. So this episode is probably going to be slightly longer than our usual episodes, because we have plenty to talk about, including discussing the appearance of the Enterprise and Such Sweet Sorrows Part 1. Obviously, can't do this episode without talking about the finale for Season 2 of Star Trek Discovery. Some new news on the Picard show, including more casting and director announcements, and the Deep Space Nine documentary. So this episode will be a bit longer than 30 minutes because we've got about 3 weeks worth of content to move through. But it is primo content, so I hope everyone will stick with us. Well, our first story for today relates to the appearance of the Enterprise in Such Sweet Sorrows Part 1. If you listen to my episode 3 weeks ago, before we went on hiatus, I had this long theory about how we wouldn't see the original series Enterprise, another Enterprise, and I was totally wrong, and I love that I was totally wrong. And I also love that it turns out that Tamara Deverell, the production designer for Star Trek Discovery, lied in her appearance at the Toronto Creative Arts panel, in which she said, I think it was in a press interview with Trek Movie after that she had not designed the Enterprise Bridge, because she absolutely did design the Enterprise Bridge, and boy, is it fabulous. So the article that we're discussing is a StarTrek.com article, an interview with Tamara about the design process for the Enterprise Bridge, which started, according to her, all the way back in Season 1 of Discovery. So this is how long they've been planning for an appearance of the Enterprise Bridge on the show. Obviously, in the episode, we see Enterprise corridors, we see the bridge, and we see the turbo lift. There are lots of nice little touches that tie it back to the appearance of the Enterprise in the original series, the handles on the wall and the turbo lift, the layout and placement of the bridge stations. The captain's chair is very similar. The helm console is very similar. The red railing or orange railing that runs around the outside of the bridge. There are some additions. There's a secondary corridor added to the back of the bridge, a second turbo lift. Obviously, you know, some of the console interfaces have more functionality to them according to 21st century eyes. Though plenty of jelly bean buttons, thanks to the Star Trek tour in Ticonderoga, New York, for providing those, which was just such a really nice little touch. But, it, you know, it's clear from this interview that Tamara really spent a great deal of time in thinking about how do you meld that 1960s aesthetic with the Discovery aesthetic to come up with something that hopefully will satisfy as many fans as possible. Obviously, there are some fans who won't be satisfied with anything other than them shooting the show in Ticonderoga, New York. But, you know, I thought they did a really fabulous job in executing this redesign, and frankly did a much better job to my mind than the J.J. Abrams films managed with the Kelvin timeline. I thought this was much truer to the original design of the Enterprise. But Thad, what do you think about this? I mean, did you like the design, and what did you think about the interview with Tamara Devereaux talking about it?
I loved reading the interview, and to your point about this being a better design and closer to the original than the one in the Abrams movie, that's absolutely correct, though it kind of has to be, because this one actually is the ship from the original series, whereas the one in the Abrams movie is not.
Correct.
So, I mean, in the Abrams movie, it's even commissioned at a different time. There's a whole bunch of stuff happening there. But anyway.
And it's four times the size.
No, it's not. I refuse to believe that. The windows don't match up if you actually accept that. But anyway. Anyway, that's a story for an entirely different time. One of the things that caught my eye when watching Sweet Sorrow Part 1 was the line of displays above the main displays on the back of the bridge, where they just have the colored grids.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks so much like TOS.
Yeah, it looks really good. And also the sound, you know,
the sounds were perfect
design, but they had all of those original series sound. The
turbolift switches.
Yeah.
I mean, the door switches, grabbing the turbolift handle and then turbolift. Oh, man.
And in the corridor, those like red grills.
Yes.
That kind of blocked off the utility areas from the main area of the corridor. Also, just one of those fabulous touches.
And the shape of the hallways, everything was perfect.
Yeah, it was really, really well done. And I mean, it was clear how much they agonized over every detail. I mean, there's this long, in every interview that Tamara has done over the Discovery Bridge, and I just picked out the StarTrek.com one because I thought it was the best. But in all of the interviews she's done, including with Sci-Fi Wire and a few others, she's talked about how she agonized over the coloring for the railing around the bridge, because in the original series, in some episodes, it appears to be more orange, and in some episodes, it appears to be more red. And she had a really kind of tough time figuring out, you know, what to make it for the Discovery finale. And I mean, that's just a level of attention to detail that they didn't have to do, right? I mean, you could certainly see a number of people in that same position who would just say, just pick red or just pick orange and move on without worrying about it. So it's always been really nice to see how much the production staff for Discovery really care about doing their best to be as faithful as possible to the original, obviously under the understanding that they're not just going to rebuild the original sets and shoot on them.
Yeah, if I had one thing that I wish was a little different, I miss carpets.
Yes, it did have a very shiny floor.
But that's just the way things look these days in the 2000s. But back in the day, in the original series and in 90s Star Trek, the ships always had carpet. And I do kind of miss that look, but that's just a personal preference.
Well, I'm still pulling in the Picard show for us to see a 1992 Airport Marriott style starship.
That would be amazing. I don't think we're going to get it, but it would be amazing.
I'll hold out hope until the end of the final episode of season one, in which we don't see carpet on the walls. All right, let's turn from the Enterprise to talking more broadly about the Discovery season finale, for which there are three pieces I picked out, and we'll kind of take them one at a time. First off, a Hollywood Reporter interview with Alex Kurtzman that was posted just after the finale went live. A few things that came out of that interview. One, he confirmed that Discovery Season 3 will begin 950 years in the future. So the ship was successful. Obviously, at the end of the episode, the last thing we see of Discovery is it heading into the wormhole and going forward in time. Very nice motion picture callback with the wormhole special effects. And we don't at the end of the episode know quite where they went, other than that they are safe by virtue of the of Spock seeing that seventh signal, which Burnham said she would send when they got to the other side. So Kurtzman confirms Star Trek Discovery Season 3 will begin 950 years in the future. He says, "We are farther than any Trek show has gone before, and we're very excited to see how you put the elements of Star Trek in an entirely new universe." And as we mentioned before, there really are very few references in the Star Trek canon out that far in the timeline. Daniels, the Enterprise temporal agent, comes from a point roughly around that time, though I think you can, you know, fudge the degree to which that's right when the Discovery.
It's about 100 years before this, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah. So, you know, still that puts plenty of time for things to have changed such that, you know, there don't necessarily need to be temporal agents running around in Star Trek Discovery Season 3. I'm really, you know, we know nothing about where they end up. It'll be really interesting to see kind of what sort of universe they find themselves in. We maybe have a tiny sense of what that's going to be from the short Trek Calypso, but that really did not tell us very much about what the state of the universe was. So, blank canvas. Thad, how you feeling?
I can't wait to see it. They can do, like Kurtzman says, they basically have their own sandbox to play in now because they're not constrained by what we know about it. So anything's on the table. And I am excited to see what they decide to do with this.
I'm super excited that they are doing something so bold as this. I had kind of thought maybe they would move less far into the future, maybe to the 24th or the 25th century. But then I started thinking about it and I was like, well, one of the things they've said is that they want the Star Trek shows, you know, they've got all these shows coming. They want them all to be quite different from each other, whether that's tonally, setting, characters. They want each to have its own look, its own feel, and its own appeal that will draw someone in who isn't feeling like they're watching the same thing twice. And with the Picard show coming that we know is set in the late 24th century, if Discovery had moved to that point in the timeline, there would have been a lot of similarities and overlaps between the two in terms of the circumstances in which they found themselves, the political situation, the, you know, races who were active at the time. And even if they'd stayed within 100 years of that, there still would have had to be this sort of coordinating mechanism between the two shows over something happens in one show and that therefore has, you know, potentially has a big impact on the second show. Whereas if the USS Discovery is now 950 years in the future, it's totally unshackled from all of that because the events of the Picard show, for whatever direction they end up taking, are nothing but a distant memory because so much can change in the nearly millennium that then follows. So it really does give Discovery its own blank canvas for it to do whatever it wants to do. The only thing I guess I'm a little disappointed about is they've gotten so good at the end of season two about embracing the prequel aspects to the show and in telling an updated version of the 23rd century that I was really, really enjoying that by the end. And I'm disappointed we won't really have that anymore. But overall for the show, I think this was probably, it was a really confident and bold and ambitious move. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it pays off.
Yeah, it definitely has the makings of being a very interesting, very cool looking show.
It sure does. In which, you know, who knows what's happened to the Federation, what's happened to the Klingon Empire, what's happened to the Romulan Empire, Cardassians, Ferengi, Borg. It's all a totally blank slate. Do any of those even exist anymore 950 years after the events of Discovery? Or are there entirely new races that have moved into this section of the galaxy? It's totally blank slate, which would be really exciting. But also, I think, you know, gives us the possibility of seeing some of those races that we didn't see in the 23rd century, right? Like Cardassians, like Ferengi, who just weren't knocking around the Federation at that point. But who knows where they are 1,000 years from now?
I guess we'll find out.
Who would you want to see?
Oh, man. Well, I definitely want to see some species that we know from canon mm-hmm. or from previous shows. Exactly who? I want to see what's happened to the Dominion in 1,000 years.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. All right, so that's the Kurtzman interview. Now let's turn to a TrekCore interview with Michelle Paradise. And thank you, TrekCore, for asking a number of very specific questions about the season. A lot of these entertainment outlets tend to ask much more broad and general questions for a broad and general audience. So it's really nice when one of the Star Trek fan sites gets the opportunity to ask questions of one of the writers or producers because we tend to know what's on fans' minds and get very quickly to the answers that we otherwise wouldn't have access to. So a few things that I picked out of the interview that I thought were really interesting. One, there'd been this discussion a few weeks ago when Control had first taken over Leland's body around, was this sort of a proto-Borg? Obviously, by the time we get to the end of the season, it's not that. But Trekor did ask Michelle Paradise, did you guys think about the Borg connection at any point? To which the answer was no, that didn't even enter their minds. Which I thought was pretty interesting given some of the like very clear parallels between Control and the Borg, but also, that was something I really kind of didn't want to see. So I was glad that it ended up being something different. This was the interview in which we got the confirmation that Pike refers to Number One as Una. So that's fabulous. I thought one of the most interesting things, and this also then kind of ties into the next article as well, was that the fight scene between Giorgio, Nan, and Leland was actually on the fight in, yes, which the like corridor spins and the gravity isn't working properly, was actually on a practical set that was built to rotate, and they rotated the set as the actors were fighting and just filmed it. And very little of that is done using visual effects. I just thought that was really, really fabulous. And again, as we said, Michelle, who will be the co-showrunner for season 3, was very careful not to say anything about what the third season would be about, other than that they had a pretty good handle on where they think things are going with it.
She won't even tell us if Nan is still alive.
She won't even tell us if Nan is still alive. And Rachel and Cherry, who plays Nan, tweeted something that kind of made it seem like maybe she thought she wasn't coming back, because it was very much like a thanks for everything tweet. But I guess we'll see. I mean, clearly has become a fan favorite character. So if I were the Discovery writing staff, I would want to ensure that that character stuck around, because I think she's a really great character. And Discovery now doesn't have Tyler anymore, so it does need a chief of security.
They sure do go through those chiefs of security, don't they?
At a lightning pace, almost like they're captains.
Yeah.
And then I guess one of the other interesting things about this interview that I think we should talk about is Yeoman Colt is credited, yeah, in the credits as being a part of the show, but is never named or called out. And so Trekor asked Michelle, which of the characters was Yeoman Colt, and Michelle seemed to indicate that it was the alien character that we saw on the bridge, which is interesting because Yeoman Colt was a petite blonde female human in the cage. That's going to get a lot of play. I wonder, though, just from reading the interview, the extent to which that was something that Michelle Paradise was sure about,
yeah,
or the extent to which it was something that she didn't necessarily think that was something that we would care so much about, and by a process of elimination in her mind was just like, oh, it must have been, without realizing quite how much of a stir that was going to create over one extremely minor character. So yeah,
her responses were not very definitive, like as if she was extremely familiar with the character or anything like that. It was more like she was like going through all the other people in their bridge. She's like, well, that must have been Cole.
Exactly.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. It didn't feel super confident. Anyway, I kind of feel like that's not something we will need to revisit. And since it's not technically on screen, it doesn't count as canon, or, perhaps Yeoman Colt underwent a radical transformation in the couple of years between The Cage and Star Trek Discovery. I guess we'll see.
I was definitely interested in that character when we saw her on the screen, because she kind of looks like a red Jem'Hadar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have another Star Trek Discovery novel coming later this year called The Enterprise War. It releases in July, and Jim Jackson Miller, who's the author of the article, did tweet something, I think, after Such Sweet Sorrows Part 1, in which he said, if you are interested in learning more about the Enterprise bridge crew, that he has lots of stuff in his book that explores those characters in more detail. So maybe we'll get some kind of Yeoman Colt confirmation there. My guess will be that the character, the Yeoman Colt we see in the book, will be one who is a human. But it could be the case that there's some really interesting story that potentially takes place over the course of the book that does lead to Yeoman Colt having an entirely new appearance by Star Trek Discovery. It is Star Trek, after all. It wouldn't be the first time a character has undergone a radical transformation.
So speaking of that forthcoming novel, I just like to comment that I think it's really cool that so far, all of the Discovery novels, each one has been by a different author, but they're all established Star Trek novelists. And I think it's, I hope they continue that trend.
Yeah, it's nice that they've been giving the kind of different rotating stable of authors from the Star Trek novels the opportunity to do so, because it does kind of give each book a different feeling and a different perspective and a different flair. And also nice that they've kind of been picking very different types of books. They're not kind of all Starship adventure tales. They, you know, that was true of Desperate Hours and maybe a little bit Fear Itself, but The Way to the Stars was very different. Drastic Measures was very different. And for the Enterprise War, it'll just be an entirely different set of characters, which I'm actually really looking forward to that book. So then lastly, Olatunde Osun-Samny, who was the director for episodes 13 and 14, the Discovery season 2 finale, published another one of his behind the scenes guides to the episodes, which he had done previously for the previous episode he directed this season, episode 3, Point of Light. And that had been really fun to kind of take a look behind the scenes. And this one was really long, full of really lovely pictures, great little video clips of what it takes to make an episode of the size and scale of Such Sweet Sorrows parts 1 and 2. Thad, what did you think about this behind the scenes guide? Was there anything that particularly stood out to you?
Well, I loved this because it gave us such an in-depth look at it. I hope they do more of these in the future. One of the things that I found amusing was that for the scene at the very beginning of part 1, where we see Sarek on the beach, he had in his mind crashing waves, but he didn't realize that they don't have waves in Ontario.
That was funny. I did like that. And then I guess he said he ultimately decided that having the calm water worked better for the scene than his Southern California mind necessarily imagined it with all of the crashing waves against the beach.
Yeah, because Lake Ontario isn't exactly a very disturbed body of water.
No, not a lot of surfing on the Great Lakes, I don't think. You know, the thing I took away from it was that this was just such a monumental endeavor, and that even the smallest scenes require just such a huge amount of preparation and lots of different people contributing. You know, it's not just point a camera at the actors and shoot the scene. There's all kinds of thought and preparation that goes into every second of film that's committed to the screen. The other thing I thought was interesting, just to come back to our Enterprise discussion, was Olatunde was talking about how the lighting on the Enterprise Bridge was different than any of the Discovery ships that we'd seen so far. And I hadn't realized that was the case until I read that. But now I've read it, you can really see it. The Enterprise Bridge has a much lighter, warmer lighting scheme, much more similar to what we saw in the original series than the kind of Discovery Bridge, which is much darker. And I thought that did make some really nice transitions in those episodes between the Enterprise scenes and the Discovery scenes, of moving between the two ships that had very different feels to them.
Yes. I mean, I definitely noticed that they looked different, but other than the orange railings, I hadn't really pinpointed exactly what all was different between the two.
Yeah. And it turns out, I mean, in addition to the sounds that they use, that I think a lot of it came down to the lighting, which is, it's funny how such a small thing can make such a huge difference on your perception of the set and what it is.
Yeah. And on the same note as the carpet that I was mentioning earlier, I do miss the brightly lit sets of the 90s.
Totally. Maybe we'll see some more in the Picard show. As I say, I'm looking for some shuttlecraft with carpeted walls.
Another thing that I really enjoyed from the Osun-Samny article here was him talking about how the script talked about the Burnham-Tyler kiss as, quote, the best kiss we've ever seen. And he wasn't quite sure how he was going to capture the greatest kiss ever. And Sinequa and Shazad were a little trepidatious about that too. But I thought it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I thought it worked out really well. I thought it was a nice scene. And, you know, who knows? I guess we will see if we see Shazad Latif's Ash Tyler again at some point down the line.
He's got to be in the Section 31 show, right?
He's probably in the Section 31 show. But maybe he'll also appear in a Pike show, which transitions to our next discussion, which is over the very strong fan interest following Anson Mount's portrayal of Captain Christopher Pike for CBS to commission some kind of Captain Pike Light Show. There is a change.org petition. I think last time I saw it.
I signed it.
You signed it. I signed it. The number of signatures had gotten to be pretty significant. Significant enough that Anson Mount was asked about it at his appearance at Greater Philadelphia Comic Con last weekend, which I know you went to, Thad. But you met him, right?
Yes, I did.
Very nice guy, huh?
Yeah, very nice. He said some things to me. I think I responded. I'm not sure.
Yeah, been there. But it's risen to the point where Anson was asked about it at the convention. Alex Kurtzman was asked about it in the Hollywood Reporter interview we just referenced. Kurtzman's response was, the fans have been heard and anything is possible in the world of Trek, which is a non-committal answer, but at least it shows that he's aware that there's a lot of fan interest in seeing a return for Christopher Pike. And Anson Mount, I think, has been very grateful for the response that the Pike character has gotten. And at the convention, he said he was open to appearing again as Captain Pike, but that for a Captain Pike TV show, it would require, quote, a lot of creative conversations. My sense of Anson, particularly from having seen him at Christmas with the Captains and Ticonderoga in December of last year, at which he was right at the end of filming season two of Discovery, it was that he was really, really tired by the experience, that it was quite exhausting filming that show.
And he said that at the Comic-Con panel too.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so I think while he would be interested and I think is really appreciative of the fan interest, my guess would be that's got to be weighing on his mind as well, which is just, you know, the level of commitment necessary in order to be the main character for a Star Trek show is a huge commitment. And as somebody who clearly loves his family very much, loves his dogs, that's got to be something that, you know, weighs on his mind when he thinks about what his future engagement with the Star Trek franchise will be. And I think while I would like more Pike, I also think that if all we get more of the character is what we got from Star Trek Discovery Season 2, I'm fine with that because the character now does have a pretty complete story from the cage through Discovery Season 2 through to the menagerie. We have a complete arc for this character that, while I'm sure there's more that could be added to it, doesn't require it. But what do you think, Thad? Are you totally on board for a Pike show?
Well, as you and probably most of our listeners well know, if it's Star Trek, I'm going to watch it.
Oh, me too, 100%.
But yes, I would love more Pike. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if we get more, but it's not going to be like a new show. I doubt we'll get Star Trek Pike, the, you know, 5-season TV show or something. But what I think could happen would be a limited series, or even something akin to a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I mean, in my, like, you know, make me king for a day, what I would want to see would be for the merger of CBS and Paramount to take place, for Star Trek filmmaking to be now back under the kind of main Star Trek umbrella, and for them to commission a Anson Mount, Ethan Peck, Rebecca Romijn Star Trek movie of an Enterprise adventure.
Oh, you mean an actual theatrical
movie? Oh, I mean an actual theatrical movie, yes.
Ooh, that could also be good, and I would be down for that. My only concern with that is I'm not sure when the Star Trek original series and TNG movies were out, I feel as though their respective shows were much larger pieces of popular culture than Discovery is now.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. That's why I say it's just one of those like pie in the sky things. I don't actually think it's going to happen.
Right.
But it would be the perfect way of getting Pike back, not having Anson Mount need to commit to doing 14 episodes, and being able to get an Ethan Peck and a Rebecca Romijn, you know, especially Ethan Peck. I think his career is only going up from here, given the fantastic performance he gave as Spock, that gets us something without it being, you know, 3 seasons of 13 episodes. That really is, you know, a huge commitment for those actors.
I'm still really impressed that they got Patrick Stewart to commit to 3 seasons.
Which is a perfect segue into our latest Picard show news, again, still untitled. I went away to New Zealand thinking I would come back and the Picard show would have a title. It doesn't. We do have CBS's upfront presentation taking place in the middle of May. If I were a betting man, I would say we will learn much more about the Picard show at the upfront presentation, since it's next up on the docket. Discovery is now in the rearview mirror, so they don't need to be focused on Discovery Press, and it's going to start transitioning to Picard Press. But we do have two pieces of news on the Picard show since I went away. One, we have three new cast members have been announced. Alison Pill, who most famously was in The Newsroom, Harry Treadaway, who played Victor Frankenstein in Penny Dreadful, and Issa Briones, who it seems like has had a number of stage roles in the UK, but this is her first kind of big TV performance. Just as with the previous casting announcements, we have no idea what characters these actors are playing, just that they have been cast, because we still don't even know the name of the show. But Thad, none of the actors that they've announced for this show, obviously other than Sir Patrick Stewart, have I seen in anything. Have you seen any of these actors in anything?
I'm actually surprised you haven't seen The Newsroom. Yes, I've seen Alison Pill in The Newsroom. I thought she was great in that. Also, The Newsroom is good, and you should watch it, Alex. I have seen a little bit of Penny Dreadful, so I have seen Treadaway as well, but I'm less familiar with him, and Briones I'm not familiar with at all.
Got it. Well, we are super excited to find out who these actors are playing. Of course, welcome Harry and Issa and Allison to the Star Trek family. We are very excited to have you and very excited to learn more and to see you in the Picard show when it premieres either later this year or early next year. And the next piece of news we have is around Jonathan Frakes' role in the Picard show as a director. So we found out that the Picard show, which will be 10 episodes in its first season, is being split up into 5 production blocks, and that one director will direct each of the two episodes in that block. So Hanel Culpepper has been announced as the director for the first 2 episodes of the Picard show, and Star Trek superstar Jonathan Frakes will be directing the second block of episodes, episodes 3 and 4. In an interview with TrekMovie.com, he talked about how he would be directing the 3rd and 4th episodes of the show, that did not mean that those two episodes would be two-parters, but that they had made the decision, probably for financing reasons, that the easiest thing to do would be, because it's one story told over 10 episodes, would be to shoot 2 episodes back to back each time, probably with some overlapping, just like Such Sweet Sorrows was shot overlapping from each other, because you had the one director. So that's super exciting, and also makes me think that we should be paying close attention in episodes 3 and 4 of the Picard show for a Riker cameo. That's right. I will never not talk about Jonathan Frakes directing the Picard show without giving a plug for an appearance by William T. Riker in the show. But Thad, you excited to see Frakes back directing Picard? And I guess also he says he knows he will be directing 2 episodes of Discovery Season 3 as well.
I mean, that was a foregone conclusion. He directed in Season 1, he's directed in Season 2. It made sense that they would bring him back again. Yes, obviously I'm excited that Jonathan Frakes is going to be directing for the Picard show. I agree with you that there has to be a cameo. It's just got to happen.
The fans are calling out for it, Jonathan/Alex Kurtzman.
Yeah, and I think I like how he's talking. He talks about how excited Patrick Stewart is to be doing this, because that definitely makes me feel great, knowing that if Sir Patrick is really enjoying it and really on board and excited about it, then I just know it's got to be something that the fans are going to enjoy.
And also that he's not just like phoning it in, right? Which,
yes,
some of the later movies, you kind of got the sense he was starting to get tired of playing the character. And even though he did a fabulous job, it wasn't like Chain of Command good. It was like just standard Patrick Stewart good. It seems like the stories that he's most bought into and fired up about are the ones he really spends a lot of time on. And also it seems like, you know, he's doing a decent amount of rehearsals. There's an Instagram post of him with rehearsal sides for the Picard show, even though as far as we could tell, it has not quite yet started filming. We think that's coming very, very soon. So he's clearly working on learning the lines and doing rehearsals right now. And so hopefully that all leads us towards a really fabulous product. So from the Picard show, which again, I hope we're just a few weeks away from learning a little more about, or at least learning what the name is.
At the very least.
At the very least,
if they don't announce it in a few weeks, they'll definitely have an announcement at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, absolutely. I'm expecting the first trailer at San Diego Comic-Con. But I'm so tired of calling it the Untitled Picard Show. It would just be really nice to, you know, give it an actual name.
I think there's no way it's going to be Star Trek Destiny, because I feel like if it was, they would have announced that by now.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, we just don't know. We know it's not going to be Star Trek Picard, but other than that, the sky's the limit, right? Hey, maybe that's the name for it. So from looking to the future of Star Trek, back to the past of Star Trek, the DS9 documentary is coming right up.
So excited.
Yeah, so excited. They have announced a May 13th theatrical screening through Fathom Events. So you will probably find, especially if you're in the US only, that your local theater on May 13th will have a screening of the DS9 documentary. I have my tickets for a theater here in Washington, D.C. I booked my tickets, I think, a couple of days before they went on general sale on Fandango, because I found the theater would sell me the tickets directly. And same. A few seats had already been taken. So I'm hoping this will be popular. And then don't worry, if you are an Indiegogo backer of the Deep Space Nine documentary, you will have an early opportunity to watch the documentary before the theatrical screenings. That's something that the team has always promised to us, and they are delivering on Thursday, April the 25th at 9:09 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A link will be emailed out to backers that will contain access to the documentary that will be available for 99 hours. So do you notice a theme here, all the nines? So you will have 99 hours in which to watch the documentary after Thursday, April the 25th. Your next opportunity will be the theatrical screenings, and then I think the Blu-ray release will come after that. I think the theatrical screening will have additional content that the documentary release to Indiegogo backers does not have. I think there's a roundtable discussion included in the theatrical release, so I know that I will probably, I'm not sure yet if I'm even going to watch the Indiegogo broadcast or if I'm going to try and wait. And they also released a trailer, which has got me really fired up for this. Seeing the Deep Space Nine footage in high definition was amazing. Thad, are you as fired up as I am about this?
Oh, so much. So excited for that. Also, mad props to Trek Corps for going through and finding every scene that was in the trailer and showing us the standard definition version side by side.
And that was, I can tell from having been part of the discussions of the team trying to find those scenes, that it was not easy to take shots of those actors from scenes that don't have a lot of context and paste them back into episodes.
Especially when a lot of them are from alternate shots or shots that were trimmed from the final release.
Yeah, let's just say that's big kudos to Ken Reilly for that one.
Yes. And so you're saying the theatrical release probably will have more than was in the stream. Well, then the Blu-ray is going to have even more than was in the theatrical. So I guess I'm just going to watch all three of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the only option here.
I'm so excited for this. I've talked about this before, but this documentary is what got me back into the Star Trek fandom and got me involved with the online fandom community, what got me to go to STLV for the first time. So yeah, to say that I'm excited to watch this would be a strong understatement.
And just sitting in a theater seeing Deep Space Nine footage in high definition, about 15 minutes of it we've been told to expect. My body is ready. Mm. And as I said before, on one of the previous shows where we talked about the Deep Space Nine documentary, the documentary team have been leaning really hard on the idea that the documentary, because it has high definition footage in it, is a way of sending a signal to the studio about the fan interest in not only Deep Space Nine, but in a high definition upgrade for this show. And so I implore my listeners, if you have any interest at all in Deep Space Nine in high definition, let's send a really strong message to the studio. Make sure you get a ticket to the theatrical release. Make sure you buy yourself a Blu-ray. This could be our last chance to do it, so let's not waste it.
Yes.
If there's any chance at all that we can get Deep Space Nine in high definition and the studio is watching how the documentary performs, let's make sure it performs as well as it possibly can. And that's my soapbox.
I agree.
All right. We've talked about the facts, and now let's speculate on what's going to happen in the future of Star Trek.
You make some very good points, Captain. but it's still all speculation and theory.
So each week, I and my guest are going to give you a theory we're nurturing about the future of the franchise. I was extremely pleased with my theory on the last episode, and then not only was I wrong, I was spectacularly wrong, and I love it. So, Thad, give me your totally ridiculous prediction for this week.
I think that whatever happens in season one of the Picard show is going to be referenced in season three of Discovery.
Okay.
What that is, I can't say, but I'm pretty sure they're going to tie them together.
Yeah, I think it provides a nice opportunity to, let me start my corporate speak, synergize the content between the two and kind of just, you know, reward fans of both shows for watching both by getting those little moments that connect the two together. So yeah, I think it'd be nice to put, you know, some little reference in now that the timelines sync up in such a way that they can. What do you think you want that to be?
That's where it gets trickier. But I'm hoping it's going to be something pretty serious. Like, maybe not like the main plot of the Picard show, but something that happens in the Picard show, I'm hoping is going to have, will involve a species or interaction or something that's going to have ramifications several hundred years down the line in Discovery.
So exciting. I guess that's the thing with the Picard show being such a blank canvas is right now we have the ability to kind of project whatever we want onto it, which which it's coming. It's what's coming next.
Yeah, and I hesitate to even begin to predict exactly what will happen on either show, but I suspect they will be tied together, and I hope that they find a way to do it well.
I think there will be a lot of forces that are encouraging them to do so.
Yes.
My theory relates to the Section 31 show. So Philippa Georgiou, Empress Philippa Georgiou, turned Section 31 agent, turned lead character of the Section 31 show, was aboard the Discovery when it entered the future 950 years away. And while I don't think there will be a return for the USS Discovery to the 23rd century, the end of the season two finale felt like a really strong wrap up for the 23rd century element of Discovery itself. And if they went back in time, it would open up all of the canon questions that they just tried to close. I do think it is necessary for Georgiou herself to travel back in time in order for the Section 31 show to really even take place, particularly because in the Hollywood Reporter interview that Alex Kurtzman, that we talked about a couple of times on this episode, he mentions the Section 31 show being used as a way to link the Discovery era Section 31 with the Deep Space Nine era Section 31, and showing you how the group ends up going kind of behind the scenes and transitions from being a sanctioned element of Starfleet intelligence to a totally unsanctioned rogue operation. And if Michelle Yao is going to be the main character for that, it means she has to be back in the Discovery timeline. So we know she's in season three because Heather Caden has said she's in Discovery season three. But my theory is that at some point in season three, Georgiou with, you know, potentially some other characters, potentially not, but that definitely Georgiou will travel back to the 23rd century, and that will be where the Section 31 show begins. What do you think about that, Thad?
I think it's a very good theory. And yeah, I would feel, I feel more strongly about this than I did when I was listening to your theory last time.
Yeah, after going very out there with my theory last week, I figured I needed to claw back some of my credibility by picking something that was more likely. I was thinking about going with Discovery will have a third season as my theory, but that seemed a little too much like a slam dunk.
Hey, I've seen some YouTube videos that assure me it won't. So, you know.
Well, in addition to YouTube theory, YouTube videos that say that the Picard show is close to being canceled before the cameras even run and that shooting delayed, which
that one too.
Which John Van Sitters, the CBS vice president of Star Trek, laughed off as a ridiculous conspiracy theory, which I very much enjoyed.
Well, they're all. Yes, it's good to hear a confirmation on that, but they're all ridiculous conspiracies.
They are all ridiculous conspiracy theories, and they should get no more oxygen from me. Do you have a theory or wish for Discovery or the future of the franchise that you would like to share? Tweet them to me at Weekly Trek, and I might feature your theory in a future episode. And as you know from my theory last week, there is no theory too ridiculous to appear on Weekly Trek.
It's true.
Well, that's all the time we've got for this episode of Weekly Trek. Thank you so much to my guest, Thad Haight, for joining me today. Thad, how can people contact you if they want to continue the conversation?
The best way to find me is on Twitter. I'm at Tyrannicus. That's TYRANICUS. You can also check out my Star Trek Voyager podcast, Delta Flyer, which is found in wherever you find your podcasts. I also do a weekly Stargate podcast called Stargate Weekly. That one is also on hiatus for the moment, but it will be coming back. And you can find that the same place you would find Delta Flyer.
And you can find this show on Twitter at Weekly Trek and me at Alexander T. Perry. And if you enjoy the show, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast player of choice. And speaking of which, thank you to everybody who participated in my giveaway for the autobiography of Jean-Luc Picard by David Goodman. I'm pleased to announce the winner of the giveaway is BJP. That's at BJP211 on Twitter. Check your direct messages and we will get that out to you post haste. Please check out some of the other great shows on the Tricorder Transmissions. And if you like our shows, please also consider becoming a Patreon of Tricorder, which you can find at patreon.com/the Tricorder Transmissions.
It's worth it.
It totally is worth it. And lastly, if you're looking for Star Trek news on the internet, I hope you will turn to trekcore.com. Well, thank you, Thad. Thank you to all of my listeners. And until next week, live long and prosper.